Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here for the Wagon Wheel Show, where we answer your questions on cricket. Best way to do it is if you're watching live along with us on YouTube, you can chuck a question up in a super chat feature. But if not, you can go to Patreon beforehand and subscribe as a Patreon. And then from there, you can you can go and ask as many questions as you want. By that, I mean two. Hayden says, after listening to your recent Crick Pigs episode, it got me thinking, how good a T20 batter would Damien Martin have been if he played at his prime? His ability to access the offside would have made him very hard to bowl to. I feel like he would have been a very innovative as well. He was a good fielder, and if he worked on his medium pace, he could have been a handy six bowler. You've lost me at handy six bowler. I just don't know. Those sorts of Damien Martin, I'm trying to think of other people, Sourav Ganguly, type of bowlers just don't seem to have much of a place in modern cricket anymore. I think in the old days, people would sort of knock them around a little bit, whereas now they're just going to stand there and try and smash them out the park. So you don't really see many of those right arm medium pace kind of all-rounders anymore for that reason, unless they can come up with something special. I think Damien Martin, there was a video we did on Sanju Sampson where I talked about one of the reasons he's so hard to scheme for is once he gets going, you need six players out on the boundary. And I know that you might be like, well, you need that for Andre Russell, and but you don't. Most players don't access boundary options in six places, right? So guys like Andre Russell, Chris Gayle would just hit the ball over the top. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, you could have the fielders in at the ring at a certain point, right? But for someone like Sanju Sampson, who can hit the ball absolutely everywhere, that does create a big issue. And I think that that's probably something that we'll start to see more and more of, especially now that the cover drives can be lofted and traditional batters have the ability to flip the ball over their shoulders, right? If you have the ability, so let's imagine Damien Martin exists. He can obviously hit big to the leg side when he needs to. He would be really hard to stop around point and backward point. Like, if you have a deep point out on the boundary for him, and if you think about him as an ODI player, he did this a lot, he would just hit the ball on either side of point. So you're already in trouble. He could also hit the ball down to third quite easily. So that means having the fielder up in the circle would be an issue. So I do think there is an element that in the future, that is going to be something that is a lot harder for players to bowl against people like that. So yeah, I could see how Damien Martin would have gone. It's just, you know, with Damien Martin, I think a lot of things are about buy-in. How much was he interested in doing things? Because he was an incredibly talented player who obviously had many issues throughout his career. So it's hard for me to sort of go, oh, this is what he'd do in the T20 era. But he's a very entrepreneurial guy, right? Like, I've written about his entrepreneurial businesses before. So I think with that in mind, he might have looked at this and be like, there's some money in this. I'm going to learn how to do it. But yeah, I do think that guys like Damien Martin, Sanju Sampson, who have the ability to hit boundaries on the ground and lofted in all directions, just become a very different kind of modern T20 player than where we probably originally went, which was people trying to hit to their strengths. I think those players will obviously still exist and are very, very important. But that other level as well of the ability to hit the ball in every direction, because most players don't, right? Even great players don't always do that. You know, it's something that was really noticeable when I was talking to people about Brian Lara and Garfield Sobers, was that whole thing of, they call it hitting around the clock in cricket, where you can hit the ball in every different direction. That's actually very rare for power, right? Abe says, can you think of an example where the use of data has made cricket worse? For example, by changing how players approach a game in a bad way. Well, I mean, the whole matchup thing is, it's not data's fault that it's used poorly, but it sort of came into cricket as a situation where people, I'm trying to think of the right way of putting this. It came into cricket in a way where, and this happens a lot with a lot of data side of things, the whole 3-point thing in basketball is a similar thing, where suddenly it becomes absolutist, and matchups are not absolutist, right? There are left-arm finger spinners who bowl very well to left-handers. There are right-arm off-spinners who bowl very well to right-handers. And so once you make something absolutist, you know, if you go back to one of the first big stats in T20 cricket was if you lose three wickets in the power play, you generally lose. And so teams would clam up after that, right? And it's like, well, now you're definitely going to lose. One of the reasons you're losing is because you've lost three wickets and you're pulling back. You actually might be just as likely to win if you go all out and attack after the three wickets in the power play. So I think there's, you know, lots of things like that have happened in cricket where people have got things wrong. I'm trying to think of something else that's gone. We don't use part-time bowlers as much anymore. And we're probably right not to use part-time bowlers as much anymore, but they are fun. So I'm not sure. It's cool when a batter comes on to bowl, and we seem to have lost more and more of that over time. And I, as I said, I've looked at the records. You shouldn't be bowling part-timers all that much. So I think there's lots of things where it makes it less fun or less engaging. And lots of times when data is just used incorrectly. Just to go back on that, I was just thinking, Simon Dool's always blaming the boffins. Why doesn't he ever blame the cricketers for misusing the data that they're given? I've had that happen to me as much as I've had people listen to the things I've said. Ian says, in general, if you had two players, same role, same level of natural ability, the perceived wisdom is to pick the lefty over the right-hander. But is wrist spinner the exception to this rule, as a right-arm leg spinner stock ball turns away from the majority of batters? No. I know why you're saying that, Ian. So I think you can make a pretty good case, as you said, to pick the left-hander over the right-hander in every other situation. I think if you can find a left-arm wrist spinner who is as talented as a right-arm wrist spinner, you use the lefty every single time, just because so many players around the world are just not used to facing it. And you have such a natural advantage there. And also, if you have a left-arm wrist spinner, they still have the ability, you know, their best ball is quite often still spinning away from the right-hander. So, whereas right-arm wrist spinners probably don't do as well against left-handers as left-arm wrist spinners do to right-handers. In fact, I'm positive of that. So no, I would still go for left-arm wrist spinner if all of your different questions there were answered, all your different matrixes. Crate says, it was interesting watching, was it the World Baseball Championship? Is that what they call it? And the T20 World Cup in the past 2 months. WBC was a much more enjoyable viewing experience with more upsets, while T20 World Cup had its moments. And first global T20 where so many teams looked like they could be competitive. As both baseball and T20 cricket look to expand, which would you say will be able to reach a more global market 10 years down the line? T20s have the advantage of a much bigger existing fan base, while baseball is a much more organized setup of governance. I don't know. T20 cricket is going to be a lot bigger than baseball, crates, I think, in the next 20 years. Baseball's struggling in America. There aren't that many countries where baseball is the number one sport. There's obviously a couple of very crucial ones. Japan and Korea are really important, and obviously that sort of Central America area. I'd rather have India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, though, I think, if I was... given the option. Look, cricket's already such a bigger sport than baseball. Like, I don't think they're even any way compatible. That's not to say that baseball can't have a better tournament. I saw a little bit of the coverage of it. A couple of my baseball friends got into it. It seemed fine. It seems to me like there are some strengths to that tournament and some weaknesses, and certainly we have those in cricket. But when it comes to it, I don't think baseball having a much more organized setup of governance, like, I just don't think that's going to matter. It's going to matter about how many fans you can get in. And cricket's already the second most Googled sport on earth. And baseball is not anywhere near that. The future of the two sports, if I'm investing, I'm certainly investing in cricket over baseball 100 times out of 100. Sam says, are there any players that have had a significant gap in their performance between formats that didn't make sense to you given their skill sets? Yes. Okay. Let's go through some. I think one of the most famous ones is Michael Slater, right? Michael Slater was a really attacking opening batter before Sehwag, right? Between Srikanth and Sehwag, and we really hadn't had that many players of that sort. And he ends up averaging 43 in Test cricket. made 1400s and what, about another 690 odds, and was just dynamic in 74 test matches. Had some weaknesses and everything and everything else, but wow, you know, especially early on in his innings, it was just so hard to sort of contain him. And then you have him in ODIs, this attacking player, 42 ODIs, doesn't make 1,000 runs, averages 24, and a strike rate of 60. So his strike rate in test cricket was 53. He almost struck at the same speed in both, while averaging so much more in test cricket. And my first thought was, well, look, he played 42 ODIs. They kind of, I think eventually they might have even used him down the order. Like, they tried a few different things with him, and it's fine. I'm sure his List A record would suggest that he was a fine one-day cricketer and he just didn't do it for Australia. No, it doesn't. 135 games. I'm assuming most of those were for New South Wales and Derby. There's also the 42 for Australia. So there's about 100 of domestic games in there. And of those, he made 200s and 27 50s and averaged 27. We don't have a strike rate for that one. It was a bit before we had all those records. But yeah, I think you'd argue that he didn't make it work in either. I'm trying to think of some other players. Is Scott Boland maybe some like a modern version of this? You know, I would have thought that he is someone who also could be. I'm trying to remember what he. I know he played a couple of one days, but I know he's not a particularly good. Because I think I've looked up Vernon Philander before, and I think his limited overs figures are pretty good, and probably should have played more franchise league cricket. Let's just have a look at Scott Boland. Yeah, Scott Boland's List A bowling average is 41. 41 for Scott. No one can stay in against this dude with the red ball. And in T20 cricket, it's better, but he's still going at almost 9 runs and over. He's another one. So there's two Australians. I'm trying to think of some other players from other countries that probably should have been better in a second format. I mean, Ian Botham's maybe one of the most famous ones in ODIs, but I just don't think Ian Botham took one-day cricket very seriously, so I don't know if I should be taking his figures all that seriously. Yeah, so there would be probably some other players that I can't think of off the top of my head, but yeah. I think sometimes I don't have a great answer to why. Like, I think late-stage Scott Boland is such a metronome that I wonder if he went back to one-day cricket. But he still played T20 cricket and hasn't worked. Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer for that. Reece says, in terms of being miles better than the level they're playing at, who is the best you've seen live? Example, Ramprakash at Surrey when you first came to England. Yeah, Ramprakash in county cricket was ridiculous. I saw Chris Rogers play a little bit of county cricket too, and there was a similar kind of thing with Chris Rogers. I don't think he had the numbers to back it up, although I think I saw his double 100. I might have seen 100 made for Middlesex as well, double 100 for Derby, where there were times when I was looking at it this going, this is ridiculous. But yeah, Ramps is the one that springs to mind. I'm trying to think if there's an associate cricketer who I've seen in a game. I just thought to myself, this is a completely different level. Maybe early career Rashid Khan in associate level, actually. Because I think I started really focusing on Rashid Khan when he took a 10-wicket haul against England Lions in a first-class game. And I watched quite a few of his games after that. And yeah, it was very, very clear. Trying to think if there's a women's version of this as well. I feel like there should be. I mean, there were certainly times when Meg Lanning felt like she was a completely different level of cricketer than anyone else in her games. So maybe Meg Lanning would be another one that I would have up there, and she was playing with a great Australian team and still just felt so elevated above everyone else. But yeah, I think those are the ones off the top of my head, Reece, that make the most sense. Let's take a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel. And when we come back, it'll just be more of this. It'll just be more of me talking about cricket to you. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Josh says, Boxing Day 2026 New Zealand is going to try to win their first Test Series in Australia since Hadley's 1985 brilliance. Is New Zealand's current team better than that 1985 Australian team? 1985. Jeremy Coney won't be happy with this. 1985 Boxing Day Test. What do we have here? Was that 86? I thought it was 86. No, can't find it at all. Okay, I'll try again. Australia, New Zealand. It might not have been Boxing Day, was it? I'm trying to remember exactly. Brisbane. I'm trying to remember back to how that series went. Yeah, because India were over as well, weren't they? So, got a lot of one-day games here. It's incredible, actually, when you go back and you realize just how many one-day games were played in that period. Okay, so New Zealand versus Queensland. So what's that one? Brisbane. And they played New South Wales in Sydney. Then they played the Wacker. Oh, I can't even find the game that you're talking about. No, they didn't play in Melbourne. That's what I'm looking for. Okay, so let me just pick a random test here. So where did New Zealand win? They won by an innings in Queensland, and that was the Hadley game, wasn't it? So that was December 85. Okay, so they had Edgar and Wright opening the batting. John Reid, Martin Crowe, Jeremy Coney, Jeff Crowe, that's pretty strong middle order for them at that time. Richard Hadley, Ian Smith, Martin Sneddon, Ewan Chatfield. So who would New Zealand, was their last test versus India? When was that? All right. No, it wasn't versus India, was it? Oh God. I'm trying to find their last test match. If we just take, West Indies. Okay, so what's the scorecard there? All right, so the openers of that are Latham and Conway. I think that they've certainly had better, I think Edgar and Wright is an incredible partnership. But I think if I'm taking them all on talent, I'm probably taking Latham and Conway. Okay, then you've got Williamson at first drop. So let's say Williamson and Crowe kind of even each other out. You got Ratchan Ravindra and Daryl Mitchell. And you've got John Reid and Coney. I think you would want... John Reid's pretty good, though, isn't he? Just doesn't play many test matches. I think you give the slight edge to the modern side there. So I give the edge on batting to the modern side. And then on bowling, you have what? Duffy, folks, AJS Patel, Michael Ray. So who could you add to that? You could add Matt Henry to that. You could add Kyle Jameson to that. I'd say that team back then, the New Zealand team, is a better team at the moment in terms of just raw talent. But that was also a period where you had Richard Hadley, and it's sort of hard to compare a team with Richard Hadley to a team without Richard Hadley, because he was so great and he gave them batting as well. So he made their batting order longer. So even if there's a slight talent gap all the way through, like, you would definitely pick Matt Henry and Kyle Jameson and Jacob Duffy over Martin Sneddon and Ewan Chatfield, I would think, just off the top of my head. But Matt Henry compared to Richard Hadlee is an incredible drop off, right? And so you do give yourself, you know, a lot of flexibility there. But here's the important thing that you need to know. 1985 Australia, Kepler Vessels, Andrew Hilditch, David Boone, Alan Border, Greg Ritchie, Wayne Phillips, Greg Matthews. So not a particularly strong batting lineup. Boone was young. Border was very good. Vessels was very good. The rest of that batting is quite flaky. Greg Matthews is the main spinner with Bob Holland, who was about 50 years old. Dave Gilbert, Jeff Lawson. Jeff Lawson was a good bowler, replacement level bowler by Australian standards. Craig McDermott was quite good, but also quite young. And compare that with the team that they're going to play this time. So it's just a very different level of cricket, right? So you can be better and still be worse just because the opposition is better. But it's a fascinating one also. And Richard Hadlee is such an important swing player in that team, in probably up there with Murali and Fazal Mahmood as the most important swing player a team has ever had, just because he's almost a one-man bowling attack. Ali says, how does winning make financial sense for franchises? Does performing better on the field lead to better profits? How specifically? So if you look at the biggest franchises around the world in sport, the vast majority of those built their backbone on winning, right? So if you look at Manchester United, you know, the Spanish teams, even Manchester City when they started winning, right? If you go to America, so, you know, the Cowboys, even though the Cowboys kind of stopped winning once Jerry sort of takes over the team, before that, their success is largely built on the back of being a great side and winning a lot. The Lakers and the Celtics in basketball, right? Like, you can go around the world. Eventually, it makes a much bigger difference. Now, some of those franchises are also in really good cities, right? And so that also plays a part that you can't ignore. But remember, you know, with Manchester City was, when I grew up, Manchester City was the team that was like a bit of a joke, right? Like, they were the unsuccessful team from Manchester. And so they still had all the advantages of being in Manchester. They have more fans. You know, they're a really popular team in Manchester. And yet not winning basically made them irrelevant, right? You know, one of the few football teams that I'd ever kind of passed my eyes over was Nottingham Forest, right? And why? Because they were successful. And so there was something to have a look at. So I do think that it eventually makes a big play. It doesn't really make a big play in the sort of the shorter term. So if you're someone who wants to buy a franchise now and sell it in 5 years, knowing that there's other rights deals coming up and everything else, I think just owning the franchise is, you know, because the whole rights package is going to go up. But if you're looking at that sort of, I've forgotten the guy's name, but the guy who bought the Lakers bus, if you're looking at the, you know, sort of the bus family style thing of things, or the Cowboys style of things, essentially, I think winning plays a big part in it. You have to build the hype of that team. Once you've done it, I don't think you have to keep winning, right? But I think you do need a successful run at a certain point, and then you can kind of cruise on the fan base that you're building, maybe the excitement and everything else. But I do think it plays a pretty big part in it. And then eventually everything is worth more that you do. Your advertising is worth more. You can put your ticket sales up. You can have more partnerships with people. You know, people like winners. Prudvi says, what is your go-to shot while shadow batting? So John Norman put this tweet up years ago, and still the best tweet that John Norman's ever put up, where he basically asked the same question. And I remember just so many replies from people. Mine is just, it's like a clip off the pad, like a back foot kind of clip off the thigh pad. I've never really understood why it's my shadow's shot, but it's something that I've been playing for years. I'm not sure it's a shot I play all that much in actual cricket. Maybe when I was in Australia, because on the sort of harder, fast, especially on the synthetic wickets I grew up on, maybe that's where it comes from. But I can't think of it being a shot that I would play all that much on an English wicket these days. Certainly doesn't feel like I play that shot. But yours is facing a Jaffa that I'm lucky to survive. I think that says a lot about you as a human being, Prudvi, I think. Mob says, timeless tests, rest days, storming the wicket at the end of the match. India and Pakistan playing bilateral tests. New Zealand women playing any tests. No batting helmets, home umpires, overcrowded hordes draping dangerously off stadium edge rooftop. What is the one thing that used to just happen in cricket but doesn't anymore that makes you think, I can't believe they did that? Or I can't believe they don't do that anymore? I mean, the rest days is ridiculous, isn't it? I think when this question came through, Mob, I didn't see all your things at the top. And the first thing I thought about was rest days and just how much extra money was spent on cricket because a whole extra day was there that wasn't used. I think that's crazy to me. You know, I'm doing some stuff at the moment. I think that helmets come 40 or 50 years earlier. If England had covered their pitches and Bodyline had not gone down as controversially as it did. So if Bodyline just gets played and everyone's like, fair play, you know, you got to protect yourself. That's part of the game. I think helmets would have been invented a long time earlier. So I think that's a fascinating one on helmets. There wasn't really a reason before 1920 to invent them, if we're being honest. Not enough people, you know. So if you go back, cricket pads get invented 1840-ish, around that period, 1835, maybe 1845, 50. I'm trying to remember when Alfred Min had his leg broken, but it's around that period, right? And the reason they were brought in is because people were getting their legs broken all the time. Like, there was just a lot of leg breaking. There wasn't a lot of people getting hit in the head from batting in from that period up until helmets. It's really after the 1960s, 1970s. But even having said that, it's fascinating to me that we didn't get there earlier. So yeah, I suppose, you know, rest days is the thing that I can't believe ever happened. And helmets is probably the thing that I think if the sport had just slightly evolved in a different direction, I wonder if we just would have got helmets a lot earlier. But all things considered, they still came really late, like way later than you would expect them to have come. Ajit says, as someone who's still getting into and learning new things about women's cricket, who are some of the youngsters' careers right now that you would suggest to follow just because you think they'll be pretty big, if not the biggest in the next 5 or 10 years? So far, I have Litchfield, Vol, Sutherland, Kerr, Marufa Akhtar. That's a pretty good list to start with. I'm trying to think of how far you want to go down the rabbit hole of there's some very good younger Irish players coming through, but I'm not sure if you want to go in that kind of direction. Obviously there's the Wolf. I suppose, does she still count as young? How old is she? Is she 24? I mean, she can't be old. She's 26, so she's probably on the verge. I'm really bad with women's cricketers' ages because I know that they are in general, obviously, younger, and it just throws my brain out in such a way that I struggle with women's cricket ages as much as anything. I'm trying to just see anyone else. Obviously, Shafala Varma, Alice Capsey. I just put in some younger players to have a look. Those ones, I think. I would take a good look at Danny Gibson as well, just because I think it's really fascinating that she's gone for so much in the 100 auction. So she's certainly another one that I would have on the list of being interested. I'm trying to think if there's any fast bowlers coming through that I've missed. But yeah, Hypercourse is the person to ask on Twitter. He looks at that a lot more. Even with young male players, I don't do as much of that kind of scouting because it's just a whole nother extra level of things I would need to do. And I haven't quite got there yet. PJ says, which bowlers of the past would have had way more wickets because of DRS? Off the top of my head, I feel like Warne and Murali would each have had a couple of hundred more. Alternatively, which modern bowlers would have had would have as much wickets without playing in the DRS era. I mean, Warne and Murali both adjust their game to DRS, so I'm not sure that you get a couple of hundred extra wickets, but we definitely see them as older guys understanding how DRS works. So the umpires, before DRS comes in, umpires actually start to give it DRS decisions. So I want to say it's from 2004 onwards, you can actually see that umpires change through the data of how they're giving out LBWs to spinners. So it does actually happen during Warne and Murali's career. And it probably happens earlier for Warne because the TV umpires in Australia, the umpires in Australia had more access to the TV gimmicks from Channel 9 at that point. But yeah, it definitely, it happens a lot earlier than you think, PJ. So both of those guys do kind of bowl, get that way. DRS, I think it's probably something that helps the Asian spinners, like in Asia, so even the Western spinners, but when they go to Asia a lot more, just because I think that in those days, the way to play them was to take the step and a half down and try and smother them. Once you take that option away, I think it becomes very different, but I suppose you're looking more at the faster spinners. So I would go to, and I've now forgotten his name. I would go to Bill O'Reilly. I want to say Jim Laker, but maybe he's not quite, Derek Randall is maybe a better option than Jim Laker. Hedley Verity would be another one. Trying to think of some of the older, quicker spinners. I think Anil Kumble is someone that, again, I know he got some of it. Chandrasekhar, maybe it would have been one of the better, really good options. Those guys who I think you need to be a little bit quicker as well. So, like, I'm not saying I think if Bisham Beatty plays in that level of cricket, though, he probably still bowls a little bit quicker because it just makes more sense. So, a lot of those guys are bowling to that period. So, let's take Warne. Warne's a great example of this because you could see it happening during his career. He starts off basically bowling a lot more side spin on the ball and, you know, trying to rip the ball back past, you know, or around your legs or whatever that may be. But by the end of his career, he's very much more trying to get the ball to occasionally just go straight down, but look like it's going to be a leg spinner. That is really coming on the back of the fact that you can't just do a huge forward press to him anymore and be not out, which is what happened early in his career, right? It was very hard to be LBW out to Shane Warne if you took a huge step forward and you were hit on the pad, as long as you were playing a shot, right? By the end of his career, that's very different. So Bisham Beatty is a very, very slow left arm finger spinner. And it's possible that he didn't have the ability to bowl at the kind of pace that you would need to for DRS. But he was a great bowler. And I just don't see how he doesn't develop to that. Whereas I think specifically the bowlers who are really, really good at that sort of stuff are going to be those kinds of spinners who are naturally a little bit more quick. But I don't want to say that Prasanna or Beatty or Clary Grimmett couldn't have worked it out, because I just think they were great bowlers and they would have worked out whatever was in front of them. But if you're looking naturally, I think the same bowler I would think of straight away, and I don't know why he's getting double mentions in this wagon wheel, but it's Richard Hadlee, right? Richard Hadlee's best delivery is made for DRS. Like the wobble ball, even though it's not the same delivery that Hadlee bowls, the wobble ball is like a variation on Hadlee's best ball. So Hadlee's best ball is bowling very close to the stumps, which is, that's where it's different to the wobble ball. But it's then angling it back in so it pitches on about middle stump. And then if it swings away, it takes your outside edge. If it swings just a little bit, it can still get you out LBW or bold because it's straightening up. And if it goes dead straight, it's a chance of getting leg stump. And because he hasn't gone too far on the angle, I think the way he got LBWs in New Zealand, as much as away teams complained about Richard Hadlee getting all those LBWs, I think if he played the DRS era, I think those New Zealand umpires were still giving him not outs when he should have got outs. I really do believe that the length he bowled, the line he bowled, and the deliveries he bowled were made for DRS. And I don't actually know how you would have played him in this era. The closest we would have been Jimmy, but I still think Jimmy bowls a lot wider. Jimmy bowls in the corridor. Whereas if you go back and have a look, Hadlee was much closer to the stumps. And Jimmy was bowling really, especially when he was bowling outswing, was bowling for caught behinds and caught and slips. And Hadley is bowling for bowled LBW and caught behind. So I think he would have been absolutely incredible. I'm trying to think if there's any other older bowlers. I think I mentioned Hedley Verity before. You know, again, another, you know, one of those quicker spinners from back in the older periods. But those are the ones that come off the top of my head. Anyway, quick break and then more of this. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Hurt says, please talk a bit on how Combox in its full glory can enhance the experience of a cricket fan across the globe. Don't leave a detail. I have to leave some details. If you wanted me to talk about Combox properly, it would take about 5 hours. And we're in the middle of pitching to people at the moment, again, to try and get some financing. And we've actually had to write a script to make sure that me and Robbie don't go. We don't turn some of these pitches into 90-minute chats, because there's so much there. Look, I think the issue is that Crick Info and then Crick Buzz are both really great at serving fans during the game, and they're really good at, well, especially Crick Info is really good at the sort of the magazine coverage of cricket, and they're both pretty good at covering the news, right? And they're both billion-dollar entities, and rightfully so. When the game finishes, I don't know where fans turn to at the moment. I don't know where you would go. I don't know where you would go if you want to know who your team's backup fast bowler is when there's been an injury. I don't know where you would go for a conversation and why your team has lost 3 games in a row, all at home. I don't know where you would go if you're not a fan of maybe the Indian men's team and perhaps the English men's team and maybe a little bit of the Australian men's team, to actually find out that much about where your team is going, why they're headed, who their coach is, what the coaching strategy is. There's no beat reporters. There's no stories from your teams. There's also all these incredible cricket minds out there who retire at 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, and then have to go off and get other jobs at the moment, rather than talking about the thing that they actually know the most about. I just feel like there's so much more that can be done. And we haven't really, you know, we've had a very soft launch. We'll have maybe we'll continue that soft launch for a little bit until we get funding. But at a certain point, I just think that cricket is a sport built around conversations, and the media hasn't done that yet. I don't think the media has ever quite nailed cricket the way it is. It's funny, I was listening to Vic Marks was talking about this recently, about Cardiff and about how he changed it. So before, the original match reports are very kind of, this team won the toss, these openers went out to bat, and then tells you the story. Very matter of fact. Then we get this little bit of like sort of color and narrative around cricket writing, which is quite enjoyable. And sort of that sort of Neville Carter sort of comes in and makes it all about narrative and everything else. And then cricket writers kind of chase the great lines. I think it used to be in the Manchester, the Old Trafford press box in the toilets. They used to have like great lines from cricket writers. And I think, and especially in England, there was that thing of like, can you come up with a line that, you know, can you call the player the nickname that is going to, you know, stick with them for the rest of their life, or come up with a line that defines them, or whatever that may be. And then we get this sort of Crick Info generation come through, right? Of which obviously I'm a part of as well. And we become the first generation who has the ability to watch cricket on the TV and at the ground at the same time. We suddenly are much closer to the action. It's a global sport rather than being a local sport, so you can cover teams from any. You don't have to cover your own team anymore. All these different things happen. Then very quickly on the back end of that is the sort of the analytics revolution. I think that what we are about to have now is a combination of all of those things through videos and podcasts and everything else. And what's missing at the moment is the professionalism, right? It's not that there aren't great cricket storytellers, whether they be writers, analysts, podcasters, former players, whatever. But there's a lack of professionalism to bring all that together. And I think at a certain point, that's what Combox wants to be, right? You know, we want to answer kind of every question. We want to cover it completely, this sport, in a way that we don't think it's ever been covered before. You know, the cheap way of saying it is we're trying to Americanize sports coverage. But we're not really. We're really, what we're trying to do is make the off-field conversations that you have with your friends. It's in the ads. Make those exist permanently online at all times about cricket. And that's really where we want to take Combox. Ellie says, considering IPL continues to poach players, how can the PSL put in guardrails and coexist in the same window? Or is it wiser to just move to a different window? I like the idea of them being in that window because it allows them to have the second best players available on the market. But that also means that they have to accept that during the tournament, they are going to lose some, certainly before the tournament starts, they're going to lose some of those players. And I think, I just done a short video on this, Ellie. I think that's the issue at the moment is they're in this thing where they believe that, where they believe these players should be banned. I'm like, well, no, but if you can't pay them what another league's going to pay them, of course they're going to go off and play in that league. And then if you're in a situation where you can't do something like that, then suddenly you're going to make less money. Right? Sorry, let me put this again. If you're in a situation where you can't handle that and you suspend a player because they've gone off to the IPL to make more money, your league is worse the next year because you've banned that player who might now not have an IPL gig. How does that help you? I just don't get it. So I'm not looking at it as the IPL continuing to poach players. I'm just, they're bigger fish and they're going to bite more smartly. So yeah, the PSL either needs to move it away or, but when you talk about guardrails, what guardrails can you do? You either have to match the IPL money or accept that you're the second biggest league. I don't think there's another way of doing it. Mop says, it's July 2007 and famed editor-in-chief Jared Kimball has just received millions in investment from ESPN for his niche Crick Info live scoring. So I don't think it was niche at that point, Mob. I think it was, at that stage, it was about 80% of all cricket market online. with the benefit of hindsight, how would you have developed Crick Info to maintain both quality of the product and market dominance, given the impending rise of forces such as Team India, T20, BCI, CrickBuzz? Coaching records? Yes, I would have coaching records at Crick Info. Focus on associates and women's cricket, sponsorship and collaborations, pivot to video. So I was part of their pivot to video. I think I was the second video person hired at Crick Info. So I was very much a part of that. I was trying to tell them pretty much from the time I started. So I started just after 2007. I would have been there around 10, 11, I think, Mob. I was telling them from the start that I thought they were covering it wrong. My theory was at the time that what they were trying to do was cover all stories in cricket with major writers, whereas actually what they should have been doing was making sure that they covered all the news via desks, right? And made sure the beat writers were in part of that, but that every single cricket team needed proper coverage from a beat writer so that there was no reason to ever go back to a newspaper if you like cricket, because the best cricket writer following your team would be on Crick Info. You would have the scorecards there, and then you would have all the news from the rest of the world. You would just be much more served. And if you look at the Athletic model, that's kind of what I was saying. And in 2010, I tried to get this off the ground separate to Crick Info because I knew that Crick Info weren't doing it. And in 2012, I want to say, I went to Crick Info trying to do the same thing with podcasting. So I think those are the things that I saw a long way out, which was, you know, because I would write on these random countries, right? I would write on Bangladesh and suddenly I'd have all these Bangladesh fans come over and ask me all these questions about their team. And I was like, well, they need this, right? And so I think that's where Crick Info should have probably gone around that period. But I think that if you look at Sambit and I are very different. We're obviously very close and he's the person that brought me to Crick Info in the first place, but we're very different. Sambit is really a magazine guy. And I think even though I write more like a magazine writer at times, and that's probably where I've had my training and everything else. I'm also very much an online guy. And so I think Sambit probably dragged it more towards a magazine style, which is great. Look at the great writers they've had through there and the great articles and everything. It's just not really a magazine world anymore, right? And I think that they don't use their best talent. It's ridiculous that it's only been the last couple of years that Sid Monger started doing video and podcasting stuff and commentary. And look, some of this is on Sid as well, but it's also on the management of not pushing some of the... Nagraj would be great on a podcast. Nagraj should have his own podcast, right? Sid should have his own podcast. KK should have... All these guys, there's no reason for them not to do that. And it's not just Crick Info I'd have a go at. The Guardian has been... The Guardian is sitting on such incredible sports writing talent. You know, I remember when The Guardian hired Ali Martin, I was like, that's a really interesting... hire. I think that's a fantastic, I think Ali would be great because he can be a beat writer in the way that maybe the Guardian Cricket hadn't had before. And then on top of that, I think he would have been perfectly suited to doing podcasts and, you know, and videos and all these sorts of things. And these companies just don't see that. And, you know, maybe I always saw this world differently than they did. But yeah, I think for me, it's about making sure that fans know everything they need to know about the teams that matter, right? And I would have done that step by step, I think, if I'd been involved with Crick Info from the start. And then also making sure that there is a discussion around those things, right? Don't just let the person write and then go off and try find the next story. Get them on a podcast to chat to hosts about it and to explain why it matters and everything else. So I think for me, those are the most important things. And that means... that naturally, I just want to get back to the bit that you've also, oh, I think I muted that sneeze. I think that sneeze put me out of focus. But I think that that takes you back. So when you start talking about associate and women's cricket, it's a perfect example of why Crick Info can't cover associate and women's cricket, right? Now, some of this is also to do with Samba and what he likes. But it's, if you're doing magazine coverage, associate and women's cricket is actually really hard to do. If you're doing beat coverage and you're covering each side as they become important, then of course, one of the first things you're probably going to do is get a women's writer for all women's cricket. And then you're probably going to end up with an England one, then an Australian one. And then, you know, you go. It's the same with associate cricket, right? A lot of the great work that's been done on Crick Info by associate cricket has been Peter Della Penna almost fighting Crick Info, right? But again, I'm not blaming the Crick Info setup for that. It's just that the way that evolved and, you know, the way that they took it, I think they could have done it in multiple different ways, you know. But I mean, this is why I want to do Combox, because I've been working in this industry for 20 years now and I know what's not being done, and I know that cricket fans can get a better product. And this, and Crick Info is brilliant in so many different ways. I don't just say that, you know, I can tell you a million things that's wrong with it, but one of the things is the sport of cricket outgrew the way that Crick Info was covering it. And that's not their fault, but they didn't pivot. Abe says, what do you make of AB de Villiers' claim that T20 stats tend to overrate openers because of the power play and that this unfairly skews how we judge who are truly great T20 batters? Yeah, no, he's right. I mean, this traditional T20 stats don't really... Traditional stats in T20 aren't really that helpful at all. Talk to Rob Barron. He doesn't use them when he's betting, right? Because they don't help him. They are very limited and they don't help. Even some of the first advanced stats, I remember working with someone who came up with this really good stat, and I said, it's not right. And he said, why is that? And I said, because the top 20 batters, 18 of them are openers. It doesn't make any sense. So anytime you come up with that, you have to do that. But yeah, that's why we have the true stats, right? I mean, true economy is much fairer. True strike rate is much fairer than strike rate. You know, we've got a video coming out later this week that will talk about Dhoni versus Kohli as T20 players. And it is fascinating when you use true strike rate, what you actually start to learn about these two different players. So, yeah, no, I'm 100% with him. It's not just the power play. It's the same with the guys who bat at the death as well. The guys who bat at the death have these great strike rates of like 150. And you're like, yeah, but the overs that are in, maybe they needed to score at 160, right? Or 170. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I also, though, not want to go back against AB because I think he's 100% right on this, but also I want to say that like getting your openers right is probably more important than getting any other spots right, because openers face around 25 balls a game. So that's another step back in there. Any thoughts on his suggestion that we eliminate the power play? No, we don't need to. We just need to talk about things better. No, I have said before, though, two fielders out in the first five overs, three in the next five, four in the next five, and five in the next five actually probably makes the most sense, but I don't think we're ever going to see it. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Sam says, thoughts on McCullum, on England sticking with Keys, McCullum, Stokes. I'm not a big sack the coach person in general, partly because I think there are many different teams, many different reasons teams go through ups and downs, right? And so I think it's ridiculous if your only answer is to ever sack the coach. You know, I don't want to get to Sri Lankan men's team or Sacramento Kings in the NBA. Which I did a short video on, I think, recently. I think when it comes down to it, you've got to be realistic and be like, we went out and we found the person that we thought was going to help. And I would say that with Key, McCullum, less so Stokes, but certainly Key, McCullum and Stokes, there is an element of they are trying to change their cricket forever, right? And they're trying to change the kind of cricket they play and change the actual DNA. And I think Key and McCullum can still help with that going into the future. My issue is that they've come out and done a bunch of press conferences where they said, you know, oh, we've had some learnings from the Ashes and everything. And I'm like, fine, great. You should always be learning. But there are many other times when teams, when the media was questioning them and saying, are you learning anything? And they're like, no, we're doing things the right way. This is fine. And so I look at it, go, so now you have to say that you've had learning. But if they haven't been learning over the 4 years, I worry about that a little bit. I think what happened is you had a weak cricket culture for many different reasons, where suddenly you had this incredible force of personality at the top of it. Then he had success, and then they let him get away with a bunch of unprofessional actions. They're not good enough fielding. They don't do enough fielding practice. Their skills aren't as good as they should be. They don't do enough training. They've become probably, in my career, I don't think I've covered a team that drinks more than they do, right? And considering I started 20 years ago when drinking was a bit more prevalent, how has this been allowed? McCullum got away with a lot of things because of the early success, and I think he should be held accountable. That doesn't necessarily think I think he should be dropped. I think he should have been held accountable even when they were having success. I think what happened is he was the savior. And then he took, like, they thought he was going to be the savior beforehand. Then he was the savior. And so they bought into it. I'm like, great. That's bullshit. No one cares about that. That's narrative for press. As a cricket team, you should be trying to get better every single day. Are you doing the right things? And quite clearly, they were not. Everyone knew this. Anyway. Reese says, mainstream football punditry in England is so incredibly tribal and unintelligent. Is cricket journalism better or worse in that sense? Not an expert in English football journalism. I think there's some really interesting parts of English football journalism that sort of Jonathan Wilson and zonal marking and even TIFO and all these sorts of parts that all come out of England, right? I'm pretty sure, which are fascinating. So I don't want to go, oh, it's shit. But yeah, like having listened into TalkSport when they're doing football, there is like, it is a lot of people yelling about their team, right? I think English cricket journalism is quite different because it tries to be more independent and global than other countries have. Like, you know, the no clapping in the press box thing. If you, Bangladesh, sometimes India, but Bangladesh journalists do not adhere to that at all, right? I think one of the reasons I wanted to be a cricket writer was I thought that Australian cricket writing was too, I don't want to say pro-Australian because that's the wrong way, but I didn't think they actually talked about the cricket. They just talked about how great Australia was at cricket, which is a very different thing. So I think cricket writing is very different in general to all forms of football writing. But I do think, as I said before, that it got into a bit of a pattern of everyone trying to be Cardiff. And then there's also a little bit of the, well, we're England and we're very important side of it, and you know the way we look at the game is correct, whereas obviously like a lot of the stuff like with Mancads and Bairstow stumping, they're just talking shit, right? Like it's just nonsense, some of the stuff that is being said, although not always being said by the cricket journalists, it should be said. In that case, some of those were on the other side, but yeah, so without being an expert in this, I would say that you probably learn more about the sport of football from the football community, even if it has a lot of yelling and everything else, than you have from the cricket community. But the cricket writing is probably a lot more balanced because of just the nature of cricket and the way it has grown. Ajit says, I like comparing two captains to see how they go about things differently. For example, Dhoni absorbing pressure versus Kohli amplifying energy. Have you seen any notable differences in the way that Latham captains New Zealand in tests compared to Williamson? What about Santner and limited overs? I just find it hard to see any big differences when it comes to New Zealand because each individual just goes about doing their job and punching above their weight. Yeah, I think that Williamson was a very... I'm trying to think of the right word, but a very calm. I didn't probably need to speak all that much. It was very organized, and he understood the sort of the ebbs and flows of cricket in a way that Dhoni does. I would say he's not as good tactically as Dhoni, but in that sort of way of just being like, no, well, this is going bad, but in a while we'll make it good again. Whereas obviously other captains don't do that. I've seen Latham as being a little bit more hands-on, a little bit more practical with his coaching, maybe is the best way of putting it. I'm not sure if I have many notes about Santner. I think all three are different. They're probably just not as different as, like, I mean, one of the biggest changes I've ever seen in captaincy, and I've talked about this recently, was when Anil Kumble was captain and then Dhoni became captain. They were two different species. PJ says, Australia's modern four versus the West Indies fearsome foursome, who would have the highest ranked and the most top 50 bowlers in the art of bowling? Okay, whoa. Well, I haven't done the list yet, so we're way off that, PJ. So you would have Marshall and Garner in the top 10. I don't think Australia has anyone in the top. Marshall and Garner both have top 10 cases. Let me put it that way. I'm not sure they're both in the top 10. But they both have cases for the top 10. I don't think Cummins has a case for the top 10, and certainly Hazelwood and Stark don't. Holding probably a case for the top 25, doesn't he? I would say Cummins definitely has a case for the top 25. I'm not sure that Hazelwood or Stark does. And then you've got Roberts. So we put Roberts in that. I would have, this is just off the top of my head, I would have Roberts in a kind of similar tier than I would have Hazelwood and Stark. What was Andy Roberts' actual bowling average in the end? I wonder if you have to look at some of the World Series cricket. Would that have been him at his peak? Probably around his peak. He probably averages 25, doesn't he? Yeah, it's still pretty good bowling average. the worst bowling average of those four, isn't he? An average of 20. Yeah, so I would probably have him around the Hazelwood Stark area. And then obviously Lyon is further down. I haven't done a deep dive into Lyon to see where he comes out. So though I think West Indies would have four bowlers in the top 50 of all time. I would assume all four of those Australian bowlers end up in the top 50 of all time, but that's a lot further down the list. So I think you would rank the West Indies one higher. That said, the left arm bowler and the off spinner brings them, if you're judging them as a quartet, I think brings them right back into it. I do think that's a huge difference. You're really important for that. Hurt says, in the corporate world, management at large enterprises often hire one of the big four consultancy giants to offload liability in case something goes wrong, or simply to have someone to point at to point and blame at. Is that like McKinsey? Some coaching selections for national teams give me the same vibe. Unless we can quantify a coach's impact, whether positive or negative, this trend is unlikely to end, but is it even realistically possible to measure? No, and look, I do think there is a part of that as well of, I think if you pick the coach that everyone expects you to pick, right, or the biggest name coach or whatever, and they fail, you can go, well, go back and read. Everyone thought this was the right guy to pick. I think if you pick like a really left-wing choice, like when Australia went with Mickey Arthur, I'm trying to think of another team picking, like a, you know, England picking Matthew Mott, right? I think when you pick people like that, your decision stands out a lot more, right? So there is a lot of that. As I've said, I've worked with people in hiring coaches before, And I just think the protocols are wrong. The system is wrong. They don't really know what they want. They don't really understand coaching to ask the right questions. And I think you need a really intelligent panel of, you know, people in cricket to sit down and then just have like almost like a, you know, a moderator there just going, okay, what kind of coach do you think will work best for this kind of squad? Where are we at the moment? What do we need? You know, do we need a more skill-based coach? Do we need a more vibes-based coach? Do we need a rah-rah coach? Do we need a chilled coach? All these sorts of things, you know, looking at the team and everything else. That's where I think cricket teams go wrong. I don't think it's detailed enough. And then, as you said, it's really hard to tell if a coach is good other than, you know, wins and losses. Like Gambier still has issues as a coach, and yet he's got wins. Justin Langer had issues as a coach, and he has wins. Would those guys have had wins if they had been coaching, you know, New Zealand and South Africa and the West Indies? Maybe not, right? That's why it's really tough. It's the same with captains, right? He streaked Steve Waugh thing. I'm not going to do it again, but I've done it many times. All right. I don't think there's many. Oh, I was going to say, I don't think there's many super chats. There's actually quite a few. Walnut says, what do you think of Masha's plan for the Caribbean Cricket podcast to sponsor player development? Any advice, plans to get involved? No, I haven't talked to Masha in a while, which is stupid because he works around the corner from where I live. No, I think I've seen people try things like this before. Usually it's more to do with associate teams in that way. But it kind of makes sense. I think it's probably a mash coming up with a common sense or a practical way of helping West Indies cricket. And, you know, I think the thing that me and Mash have talked about a lot when we've done podcasts together and just when we're chatting normally is that the big problem isn't at underage cricket. We see these West Indian players come through and we're like, oh, how good is this guy going to be? And then we don't see them again for 6 or 7 years. And that seems to be a really consistent trend in West Indian cricket. And so the players aren't developing. They're just hitting their primes. And you really want to start developing star players at 22, 23, 24. And that just doesn't seem to happen. So if that's what he's trying to do, then it makes sense. You know, obviously, I don't know how he's getting the money or anything, but I'll back Mash. If he wants to come on a podcast and chat to me about it, he can. Britt says, is there any ideal amount of seam swing movement without being unplayable? Like movement that gets more edges, false shots than beating the batter's edge. It's probably one more for Jimenez than it is for me. Once you get over 5 degrees of spin, you generally get a lot of wickets. But I do think there is a magic zone. When it comes to spin, and I would assume it's the same for seam where, yeah, as you would say, you're more likely to get edges than just miss every single ball. And if the ball's spinning or seaming so much, it's also hard for the bowler to hit the stumps or get LBWs. So yeah, it's probably between 3.5 and 7 degrees would be my guess for spin. That's just off the top of my head. I don't think I've ever seen it for seam, but it would probably be what, 1 to 2.5 degrees for seam? Again, just guessing there. Brett says, good areas was a vibe. Combox feels corporate. Well, good areas is still here. It's no different. It's still me talking crap, right? No, Combox is not corporate. I mean, if anything, I think really what we want to do is actually I want it to be relaxing conversations, right? I don't want it, you know, there'll be more corporate sponsorship, but good areas could not survive in the way it was going, right? It's, you know, it's a hand-to-mouth organization that is always on, it's in debt, actually, good areas at the moment, right? Partly because we've invested in infrastructure, but it needs something like Combox to come on. Combox is the least corporate name, by the way. It's a nickname that's used more within cricket than any other sport. Velvet says, tell me how Hilfenhaus and Rhino are different bowlers. Action so similar, record so similar. Who was better? Rhino is more famous because of Ashes. No, Ben Hilfenhaus is a very different kind of bowler. Similar body types maybe is where you're getting it. Hilfenhaus is one of the last genuine outswing bowlers in cricket. in that that was his stock ball, almost every ball. Ryan Harris, much more, he could swing the ball, but it could swing the ball in both ways and also could seam the ball, had a lot more weapons than Hilfenhaus, was faster than Hilfenhaus for his international career. He also hit the bat a lot harder than Hilfenhaus, and probably just a, I think, just a smarter bowler, really one of the smarter bowlers we've seen. So a lot more tools and everything else. Young Hilfenhaus was a beast, by the way, and I think when I saw him in Shield cricket, I thought it could be anything, but by the time I saw him play for Australia, he had slowed down. He wasn't slow, but when he was young, I just think he was a little bit different. But I thought he was still a really good bowler, but by the end, I think people had just worked out how to sort of handle the outswing, and he maybe didn't swing it as violently or wasn't as quick as he needed to be. It was probably one of those two things. But no, Ryan Harris is a completely different level of bowler to Ben Hilfenhaus. I wonder what was his overall record in the end, Hilfenhaus. I don't think he was a bad bowler by any stretch, but what would he have taken? 100 wickets? 100 wickets at what? 28. I mean, that's pretty good. But what Ryan Harris would have been at about 24? There was a bit of a fade with Hilfenhaus as well, which not his fault, but because he didn't have a long career. But he's a very good bowler. You would pick Ryan Harris. And unless you just need an in to win the bowler, you would pick Ryan Harris 85 times out of 100. Blue Eagle says, who says no for a Tilak for Rashid trade in the IPL and what gets it done? I wouldn't trade Tilak for Rashid Khan at the moment. I think with where Rashid Khan is at the moment, and you've got, how old is Tilak? Tilak Mama is 23. Yeah. You'd need to give me a lot more than Rashid Khan. Rashid Khan last year in the IPL, let's have a look at his figures. So you're trading for someone who's 27 on paper, but is probably 30, 31, right? And last year in the IPL, took 9 wickets at an average of 57 at 9 runs and over. I'm going to need more than, a young Indian batter who can be a star for the next 10 years. I can base my whole batting around them. I always favor local players when it comes to those sorts of things because, you know, once they get trapped in a side, it's hard to get them out. Blue Eagles again says, how do McGrath and Hazelwood compare in tests? McGrath's a lot more accurate. I think McGrath gets probably more lateral movement. Hazelwood a little bit quicker, maybe a little bit stronger as well. Slightly, I always think Hazelwood would have been a great back of the length bowler. It just, there's no reason for him to be that. Whereas McGrath probably needed to be that. McGrath could bowl back of a length, but he was probably better when he was a little bit fuller, sort of top of the bales. Whereas Hazelwood could have been a great sort of, almost that sort of Steve Harmison length, early Ishant Sharma kind of length, but it would have made it more successful. McGrath's just, he's more accurate. He's more skillful. I think he's a slightly smarter bowler. Hazelwood's quite smart. I think he has more weapons available to him, has an incredible memory, worked out batters completely, thoroughly, almost, you know, dissecting them. Just a better player all the way through, but Hazelwood's still a fantastic player as well. Uday says, short ODI batters video recently. I have the same top four, Kohli, Sachin, AB, Viv. Who would be your fifth best ODI batter? Mine would be Rohit or Ponting. That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. I do feel there's daylight next. I rate Ponting very high, but I'm not sure I have him as fifth. And I'm not sure I have Rohit as fifth either. I'd have to go back and have a look at it. But thank you very much. That was good fun, that one. But yeah, I don't know if I have a great answer for you on that one. Am I missing someone obvious? Michael Bevan. Emma Stone. Rohit says, LA Lakers started in 1940, sold for a record $10 billion in 2025. IPL in just 18 years, Rajasthan sold for $2 billion, rewriting sports history. Any thoughts on upcoming EPL? See, I don't think they're rewriting sports history. I just think that that's where the sport has got to, Rohit. Like, I'm not having a go at anyone involved because it is ridiculous how quickly this has moved. And this is why I was telling people 6 or 7 years ago to invest in all these teams now. This was the time. You might never be able to afford to do it again. But realistically, The reason it's gone to 2 billion, was it 1.6 billion? I thought it was 1.6, not 2 billion. Either way. The reason it's gone for that amount is because of the untapped market that was there for years, right? These things could have been worth a lot of money a long time before. But yeah, the LA Lakers, to be fair, also, what, for about 40 years? Very unsuccessful. And how much money would a Rajasthan, you know, team have been worth, even if we had a really good league around it? Probably wouldn't have been worth that much. These rights are getting out of control, and the IPL's there at the right time. You know, I'm talking to people who are trying to invest from Saudi Arabia, from Europe, from America, China. It's, you know, it's a fascinating little period of time. Anyway, that is me done on the wagon wheel, and we will see you again for more wagon wheel. And there'll be a lot of IPL coverage coming up here on Combox. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.